Take a network break, exploit the Apache Struts vulnerability, and grab yourself 145 million virtual donuts, and then join the Packet Pushers in our weekly analysis of tech news. I'm Drew Conry-Murray. Greg Farrow is on the other side of the microphone. This episode of Network Break is being sponsored in part by Nokia DeepField. Nokia DeepField provides the insight needed to increase efficiency and lower OPEX by dynamically configuring the network to improve performance and protect against DDoS attacks in real time. You can find out more at nokia.com. Network Break is also sponsored by Interoptic. You can purchase high-performing optics designed by engineers who truly understand what you need at a fraction of the cost. Get more information at interoptic.com/packetpushers and tune into the Packet Pushers Weekly Show to hear Interoptic CEO Tim Dixon as he opines about transceivers, the Shannon limit, and the future of optics in the data center.
It was a good show.
Yeah, and that'll be available after this publishes, so yeah.
Yeah, because SFPs are boring. Like, but they're not, because they're something that you actually use every day. That was good.
You found the nugget of interest there.
That's right. DeepField's the same sort of thing. Visibility is something that you use every day, but it's very hard to tell a story about it until you've got it, and then you just go, "Oh, I got it. I get it now." Anyway, that's why I go on a lot about visibility and telemetry, is because I spent a lot of time over the years trying to solve hard problems with easy stuff. Like, these are all easy problems to solve, but nobody ever has, and that's part of what makes me so ranty.
The fury. All right, well, you've got that story on the weekly show, and we'll have a link to that, but let's get to the news. Former Equifax CEO Rick Smith threw an IT person under the bus during his testimony before Congress, saying that a single employee was responsible for not notifying the appropriate IT team that a patch was available for the Apache Struts vulnerability that led to the company's catastrophic pwnage.
So, the CEO is throwing the IT person under the bus.
Wow. It's one of those deals where it's like, I take full responsibility, but it was really that guy's fault.
Yeah, it wasn't me. I met with the security team once every quarter to review security.
I was on top of it.
Like, wow, what a big effort, Mr. CEO. Totally out there. I bet you played golf more often than that. Like everything about this Equifax is like comedy on top of stupid, on top of incompetence, and this guy's testimony was just the whole thing that was going down. I watched some of the YouTube of it, and this guy is like, clearly, like, I got busted. I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't even know that IT security is a thing. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just reading words that somebody wrote on a paper. This CEO was like so out of touch with IT security that there is nothing about Equifax that any IT security professional can stand up and say, yeah, they did a good job here. I really don't think there's anything.
It doesn't seem that way.
No. So it turns out, as part of the standing up in front of the Senate committee with the U.S. government to sort of make the mea culpa and try and make it right, and giving the CEO a chance to say, this company that I love, like, who the hell says that? CEOs don't love companies. They love the money.
Right.
Yes. It's like, what?
Exactly.
You're supposed to love the job. Get out of there. So it's becoming much clearer that the timeline between when executives knew about the breach and when they knew started to do something about it was heavily delayed. There are some suggestions now that even when Equifax hired Mandiant to come in and do some security discovery, they actually got into an argument with Mandiant about how much it was going to cost, because apparently Mandiant – now, you could, having been through this a few times, I could suspect that Mandiant sort of came in and said, – yep, we can see all of these vulnerabilities, do a gap analysis, find out, and they go like, here's a list of everything that's wrong, and it's like huge. And the company doesn't like the bitter pill that is being asked to swallow. And they're going like, we can't pay for all of that, that's not in the budget. And Mandiant's going, we did the analysis, there's all the weaknesses, this place is a train wreck. You might as well just, you know, open the doors and let everybody come in, sort of thing. And I bet that's what went down.
And that's what
so
they
it sounds
for.
Like it. The patching process was wholly inadequate, like the vulnerability in the Apache Struts platform. He says that there was a human error, a particular unnamed individual who knew that the portal needed to be patched but didn't tell anybody. They might have just missed it. And then went on to say it's up to the scanning system, which should have been the second check, to didn't detect it. Now, I don't know about you, but every scanning system I've seen does not pick up Apache vulnerabilities in the Struts stuff. That's not how it works. That's not what scanning systems do. So, you know, fundamental incompetence again from the CEO not to know this sort of stuff. And I guess if they got rid of the chief security officer who was retired just a few weeks ago, if she had have known anything about it, then she would have been doing something about this as well. But clearly she didn't know much. And then just the piece de resistance. How could you make it worse, Drew? What could you do to make it worse?
I don't know what to please stop holding me in suspense.
They stored all of the customer information, all of that critical consumer information was stored in plain text.
Oh, there you go.
On the disks, right? The one thing in banks that they get, like, I've spent weeks in meetings talking about hardware encryption devices and key management so that when data crosses the network, it's encrypted. When data is at rest, it's encrypted. And it's only unencrypted for the very small amount of time that the computer needs to read it. It's absolutely like standard practice. This isn't hard. This is a solved problem. You store it in the database, encrypted. You, when it moves across the network, it's encrypted. And the only time it's unencrypted is when you need to actually read it, process it. But after that, all encrypted. No. All in clear text.
Yeah, I did read some exchanges with a couple of the Congress people who were like, did you use encryption? And the answers were kind of like, in some places we did. And they were like, where? And he was like, well, some places over here. And it was clearly just, yeah, he was not well prepared for that line of question.
This data was not encrypted at rest is like, oh.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, when the legal get a hold of this in the suing, you know, like they've got the class actions going on.
And the lawsuits.
They're just going to go like, how fundamentally incompetent are these people to go like, this is going to be so much fun. We're going to get so much money out of these people for incompetence. It's going to be fun. They're trying to do some stuff now. They're trying to blame it on nation state attackers and say, well, you know, how could we possibly defend against, you know, Russians or Chinese or the Iranians for that matter? And the answer is pretty easily by looking at it. Nice try at deflection, but yeah, that's not how it goes. So there really is no way to look at this that isn't. There's no information coming out to say that Equifax was actually doing anything right. If they unencrypted data, quarterly reviews, relying on things like scanners and single points of failure. Like if you've got a bank, right, and the bank is expecting to be robbed, what's the one thing about a bank when it's expecting to be robbed? There's no single point of failure. There's continuous reviews. There's ongoing reviews. There's tests. There's all the money doesn't sit in one vault. They have multiple vaults. So if somebody gets in, they might be able to take one vault, but you don't take them all. The money has markers on it. So even if you took it, you've got to stop the money from being marked. You know, all these sorts of things that you can do.
I believe that's called defense in depth.
Yeah, that's right. Or common sense would be the word I would
You could
say.
Also go for that, yes.
Yeah. And I mean, they mustn't have had, or like, to get this start. Anyway, a couple of articles there around this. It just, Equifax continues to boggle the mind. For incompetence, yet the funny thing about this is the reason I know so much about this is because I've worked at plenty of companies who've got exactly the same problems.
I mean, it seems like they just didn't have a sense of, it was more about we need to make this information easily and accessible to our customers, which was, you know, other banks and financial services, rather than this is sensitive information we need to be good stewards of. That seems to me that's very clear that this was their disposition, at least at the executive level.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's cheaper not to do security, not to pretend that you're a bank and to say, well, we're not covered by the SEC or any of that.
Yeah.
And I suspect that that's going to change. But, you know, they're going to get punished pretty badly for this. I actually think Equifax should be shut down. I don't think it's fixable. But I doubt that that's possible. We'll see what works out. There was some fun going on in the YouTube though, right?
Yes, there was. A little side note. There was a person dressed like Mr. Monopoly, if you're familiar with the game. He's also known as Rich Uncle Pennybags, with the top hat, big white mustache, and a bag of fake cash. He was actually photographed sitting behind Rick Smith during Mr. Smith's testimony.
Yeah.
Just that the optics are just like, it's like the one little bit of humor in this awful, disgusting mess.
Oh, it was hysterical because it was a woman and she would twiddle her mustache, put her head out right in shot and then twiddle the mustache.
Perfectly positioned to get in
and
the photos.
And then would bring out a handkerchief to tap her forehead when, because it was actually money. The handkerchief was printed with money. And she gave the CEO a get out of jail free card.
Right, yes, because I guess there's also some issues about arbitration and, yeah.
Yeah, it's hysterical. I thought it's cool. It's a bit like here in the UK this week, the Prime Minister of the UK was up giving her party speech. The path of the Tory party or the right-wing party over here is having some troubles maintaining power as we go through Brexit. And the lady in charge gave a speech which was pretty weak. But anyway, another one of these people got up and handed her a P-45, which is the US equivalent of a pink slip. And, you know, for being not very good. Which is pretty funny.
Right. The people are pushing back through comedy.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was quite clever. Well, it was pretty good, though. Bravo to the lady who did that, put all that together.
Well, speaking of comedy, in a pathetic display of one-upsmanship, Yahoo came forward last week to admit that all 3 billion of its accounts were compromised. That is up from the 1 billion the company admitted to last year, which all stems from a 2013 breach at Yahoo.
So the key story to take away, or the key thing to learn from this experience is, remember, if you ever get breached and the press finds out about it, announce something small, like we saw Deloitte do last week, right? And then keep telling them that there was more, and then there was more. And after a full review, realize that you actually got completely and utterly owned left, right, and center. So they didn't just get 30% of the data, they got 100% of the data. And nobody cares anymore, of course, because it's old news. So what the hell?
Yeah, it's just stunning. But aside from that, there's a related story. Yahoo was recently attempting to dismiss class action lawsuits that were related to the breach, but a federal judge ruled that plaintiffs do in fact have standing, so the class action lawsuits can go forward. And this ruling was handed down before Yahoo adjusted the breach totals. So that means rather than being on the hook for 1 billion compromise accounts, a class action pool could now potentially encompass all 3 billion. Very bad news for parent company Verizon. If you remember, we talked about Verizon knocked off like $350 million of their purchase price when they were acquiring Yahoo. That was under the 1 billion accounts breach number. Now that they've restated for three, I don't know if there's an option for Verizon to try to claw back more of that money or if they just got to eat it.
Well, I think a liability still rests with Yahoo because remember Yahoo still got a lot of money, a significant shareholding in a company called Baidu in China.
Right.
Which is worth quite a substantial whack.
That's essentially their entire value.
And I think most of the liability actually still rests with that piece of the business. I don't think Verizon bought the liability when it took over. Be interesting to see, but to know for certain or not. But that's how I actually remember it happening. Not that it matters to Verizon. They just want to capture the traffic so that they can sell you ads against it.
That's
because
right.
Yahoo traffic that crosses its backbones, they can then use the network traffic to get higher integrity signaling and sell more accurate ads. That's actually what you think.
Yeah, that's why they bought Yahoo in the first place, was for ad revenue. And
that's right. Yeah, yes. Surveillance. Yeah, so build a surveillance company. Yep. You know, just a corporate surveillance company instead of a government one, which people don't seem to get so upset about. But yeah, remember, announce small. Say we're doing an investigation. We'll let you know when there's more information available. But only a very small number of customers are impacted, remember. And it's going to be far worse than you think when the company says that.
And I'm sure this theory will prove out for the rest of the days that we do
this
show.
Right.
All right, a quick break to tell you about one of our sponsors, Nokia DeepField. DeepField from Nokia provides real-time insight that drives automated network optimization and security for web-scale companies, content providers, and ISPs. And on October 26th, Tony Corliss will join the Packet Pushers on a sponsored episode of Priority Queue to discuss how Nokia combines open IP network analytics, cloud analytics, and SDN automation in real time so you can deliver the high-quality experience your customers demand with the economies you need. Find out how insight-driven automation can help you make the most out of your network assets and peering relationships while protecting you against a new generation of cloud and IoT-based DDoS attacks. Tune in on October 26th to hear the podcast and learn more about Nokia DeepField at Nokia.com today.
You're going to hear a lot more about visibility on the packet pushes in the months ahead. We're seeing across the board, all the vendors are moving into this high visibility telemetry type stuff.
Telemetry analytics.
That's right. And you're going to hear a lot more about that. And especially with the rise of encrypted traffic, you have to have world-class ML/AI/, you know, really good data to pick the signals out of the noise when the payload is all encrypted. So you are going to hear a lot more about visibility tools, and DeepField is one of the early movers to market and has quite a comprehensive portfolio. As you know, we've done quite a few shows in this space over the last few months. So
strap in.
Mm-hmm.
All right, back to the news. One more security story. The Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post are reporting that Russian attackers stole sensitive information from an NSA contractor and possibly hacking tools as well. And the story cites sources saying that the contractor was using AV software from Kaspersky Labs, which is under suspicion in the U.S. for either cooperating with the Russian government or being exploited by it. And Kaspersky denies these allegations of either cooperation or co-opting.
Yeah, so this is a supply chain attack. And you'll hear a lot about that. We had the CC Cleaner attack. We didn't cover it on this show because it's really a security thing, where somebody compromised the CC Cleaner, which is a popular antivirus. Someone compromised the servers, dropped in an updated piece of updated the app with a virus or a malware thing, and then everybody started downloading it when they updated the app and started to get malware on their machines inside of their virus anti-malware stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck, right?
Yes.
So those are called supply chain attacks. Now, what is happening here is the Russian government isn't trying to attack NSA employees at such. What it's starting to realize is that the NSA does a pretty poor job of monitoring its contractors. And so the Russians have been actively targeting the contractors around the world and probably getting into them via their home networks. A lot of these contractors are taking work home. Their home networks aren't secure. They're not being screened and to the same level that full-time employees are, but they're still handling exactly the same secure data. And that's probably what's happened here is that the Russians have Whether they've compromised Kaspersky Labs at source, that is in Russia, because Kaspersky is a Russian company, or whether they've just taken advantage of a vulnerability in Kaspersky Labs, who knows? That will yet to play out. But most likely what's happening here is you're actually seeing this lack of focus or this lack of security monitoring of the contractors in your supply chain causing a risk. Now, we've seen the same thing happen to a range of companies. Remember Target 4 or 5 years ago?
I was just thinking that, yeah.
Yeah, it was the air conditioning.
Right, the HVAC company that was providing HVAC services for Target stores is how attackers got in and stole card data.
That's right. So you have to start thinking about security as everything is everything. And we have to go back to building the perimeter and controlling all of the systems in some way so that you can, if not actually to control it, at least so that you can do a forensic audit to discover what was stolen afterwards. Because a lot of these backdoor systems that get deployed onto your networks, you actually haven't got any control. You can't log them. You can't monitor it. So when you come to understand the depth of any breach, you may actually not have enough systems to tell you.
All right, we'll keep monitoring that story as it develops. In the meantime, startup Barefoot Networks has partnered with Google to develop P4 Runtime. This is a new API that enables a controller to work with programmable switching silicon. And if you remember us talking about Barefoot from an earlier show, they make the Tofino chip. This is switching silicon that can be programmed right in the forwarding plane using the open source P4 language.
Yeah, so P4, of course, is the language that Barefoot put forward to be able to advance customers' usage of its silicon, of the Tofino silicon that it's put out. And it continues to look for partners and getting that together. And the more that that gets used out there for a wide range of tasks, it does actually promote the use of the Tofino chipset. So that's why Barefoot is out there promoting it. And getting Google to pick up on it as well is very useful. Now, you don't have to use it to accelerate networking functions in silicon. You can also use the P4 language in Linux for vSwitches. And that's what's happening here. You're seeing Google and a range of other people saying, we need a way to munge packets inside of appliances, inside of NFV instances. So when we do VNFs on these, you know, x86 platforms, P4 gives us a language that could do that. And then, of course, you could start to accelerate it on other devices. So if you're on a Tofino chipset, you can now move those P4 functions straight into hardware. If you're running on a fancy NIC like a Netronome, you can start to accelerate them in the network adapter. And that's the idea behind this, is if we could get to a common way of munging packets, P4 gives us a language which could be compiled for any platform, and then the packet munging could occur with whatever the capabilities of the hardware that's available to it. So software vSwitch, still P4. Hardware NIC with some acceleration feature, still P4. If you want to run those functions directly on a switching ASIC, still P4. And the idea is to have this universal sort of language, which is, I think, very good for the industry. So the fact that Barefoot Networks is getting some support there from a wide range of sources is quite interesting. I do think at this point in time that it's likely to be a very positive outcome. I can't see any negatives here. It does take us away from this vendor does its packet forwarding this way, this vendor does it this way, this vendor does it this way, and they have magic source and we can't know what's going on. This very much moves this into the open. And so you should really try and get behind it and learn a little bit about it, I think. I'd like to commend you to do that.
Yeah, so we'll have links if you want to go find out more about Barefoot, about P4. We'll have all those links in the show notes. HPE has released an advisory that a recent service pack update for ProLiant servers could render the network adapter in the server inoperable. Ouch.
Yeah, another case of the foot guns at the ready.
pull trigger, shoot self in foot.
Yes, pull trigger. Very interesting. Like, you know, I've been banging on about bugs and weak software and poor quality control for quite some time in enterprise IT. And this is just an example of that. One of the things that I want you to start thinking about to come up with a different angle, I was thinking this week, again, talking about security, which puts me into this idea of patch management. What happens if, you know, this code, this service pack update, I don't know what it's out for. It's probably just for bugs or whatever. But what happens when you want to patch this stuff for a security fix, but you can't because you're afraid that it will break? You don't have a very high level of confidence that these big IT vendors that you're paying premium prices for can release service packs that actually work. So, you know, when you get these patches that just kill your fully functional and operational equipment, you lose trust in the vendor. But people don't punish the vendor for it. They just shrug their shoulders and say, oh, that's normal, and then just stop patching the thing. So how many people actually fit software updates to their infrastructure on a regular basis? Answer, not many of us. So if we want to get to a secure infrastructure that looks like the public cloud, we have to be able to do automated patching. And this type of activity from so-called premium vendors like HPE and Cisco and IBM and Dell, if they continue to brick hardware, you can't ever trust them to do automated patching, right? And that's a real issue that has to be fixed if we're going to go into the private cloud.
Absolutely. Code quality has to be top notch, especially when you're talking about updating existing infrastructure that essentially renders it inoperable. That is not good. Just some notes on this. It's a July service pack for ProLiant, and a story in the Register reports that the network adapter failures will only affect machines that are also running specific versions of the ESXi hypervisor. So we'll have links if you want to go check it out and check your own systems.
Yeah. And so now you're going to waste tens of hours tracking down which systems are affected. You know, that's not how it works, right? Not a good look.
Not a good look. Google, they have acquired a cloud-based single sign-on and identity management company called Bitium. Bitium service aims to make it easier for companies to manage identity and access credentials for cloud services, including Gmail, Office 365, Box, etc. Google did not disclose how much it paid for Bitium, but it makes, I think, sense for Google to be looking into the space.
Yeah, so this is very interesting. We've seen a lot of Google wants to be a enterprise company. They think that the Google Compute Cloud should be used by enterprises everywhere. And the important thing about the public cloud is, as big as Amazon and Azure is today, the real money is getting the enterprises over. That's a $3 trillion market. And they could capture a lot more, a much bigger market, if they could get people onto the cloud. And of course, enterprise doesn't take the Google very seriously for lots of different reasons, in large part because Google does things and then throws them away. It's hard to trust them for a start.
They do have a track record of abandoning projects, yes.
Yeah, that's right. And the second part is, they don't look or smell like an enterprise supplier. Enterprises have these 20-year-old ideas that sales reps should come out and, you know, warm up the seats and generally take you out for steak dinners instead of actually providing a solution. And so Google's got a whole bunch of work to do here. But one of the weaknesses has been identity management. Amazon in particular has quite an advanced identity and authentication and user management system, which very much controls it. And, you know, if you think about the cloud, if you're going to run like 1,000 VMs in there and you're being billed by the second, by the minute, by the hour, by the month for whatever it is, you're going to need to know who instantiated this and what they did and why they did it. And if you delete their access, that their access goes away, but their resources that are attached to that login don't. So all of these things are really, really powerful and absolutely core to the success of the running these services in the enterprise, like getting them to switch to that. And enterprises are generally pretty bad at ID management. So no, Microsoft Active Directory is not an identity management solution. It's a login manager at best. It's really a pile of junk in terms of identity management because it doesn't link to resources the way that you need it to do. So while you might have centralized your logins, you actually haven't centralized your identity. So Google picking this up actually shows us that they're really serious about, you know, enterprises moving into the cloud and having much more flexible identity management solutions. And it moves way beyond just the legacy 15-year-old model of Microsoft's Active Directory.
That's right. And it also encourages, if you can make it easier for folks to sign on without having to write down and memorize a whole bunch of passwords or have all different kinds of authentication and access control mechanisms, it makes the consumption of cloud services a lot easier, which in the end is good for Google as well.
Yeah, Bitium actually integrates with a wide range of login providers, so username, password, or identification, or tokens. There's a range of third parties for that that it actually can integrate with, or you can take on its own. But it goes much further than that, because when you're in the cloud, you need it to actually, you know, authorize who's allowed to create VMs, who's allowed to spawn resources, who does audit, who does control, what's my audit trail for all of these things? Can I do a forensic analysis around what was done and what was not done? And that's why Google needed to buy this service.
All right, another quick ad break. This is from Interoptic. And Greg, we mentioned at the top of the show you talked to them, so tell us a little bit about Interoptic.
Yeah. So Interoptic is a maker of SFP modules. And despite what your switch manufacturer would have you believe, it's not just like cable. Your choice in optics matter, right? Your vendors obviously want you to buy their genuine products because they put a pretty substantial markup on them because they can convince you that they've got super magic Mario powers inside. So Interoptic is a company that stands behind the optics they sell and give you a much better price. They have a full product line right the way across the board. Those SFP modules that they provide actually have code on board that needs to be updated. So make sure that when you go to buy them from a third-party vendor, that your vendor knows how to do this and you can actually get access to that code. And you want to be able to keep it updated because the vendors do keep changing the code that's inside the SFP modules, so that when you buy your Interoptic SFP modules, you can keep updating the code to make them compatible with the next generation of hardware or whatever it is that it means, right? There is a difference between generic third-party and brand equivalent optics. So Interoptics wants to tell you that they're actually selecting high-quality optics from source in China. They've been doing this for a couple of decades now. They know who they are. In the same way that you had to buy your memory directly from, say, a Kingston, who is a trusted third-party supplier, Interoptics is like that. There's a lot of vendor threats They get out there and try and get the fear into you about third-party optics, but companies like Interoptic can actually solve those for you. They do design the optics themselves, they test the optics themselves, and they write the firmware themselves, so you get a lot of guarantees. So demand from the network edge and in the campus for 10 gig, 25 gig, 50 gig are coming. Those are all going to be optical, not just on RJ45. And Interoptic understands that you're going to need a more nimble layer zero, and they support the full range of products that you need today and probably the ones you don't yet know you'll need. I love this line here, by the way, Drew. You ready for this?
Go ahead.
From a hut in the Arctic Circle to the battlefield in Iraq, Interoptic has more than 4,000 customers across 7 continents, which I thought was pretty cool.
That's pretty nice.
So, yeah, that's true. There's a lot of advantages in my experience working with customers that having OEMs, optics you can have, because you can have one optic for every switch. And literally all you do is change out the firmware in your optic. So you can move it from brand C to brand J to brand A, and you just change it out. And that way you can have spare parts sitting in a shelf, and you don't have to ring up the vendor and go and wait a day or two for a spare parts to turn up. You can just have spares lying around ready to go. So if you visit interoptic.com/packetpushers and contact them directly to get a quote, you can follow Interoptic on the Twitter as @getinterconnect. It's a bit uncomfortable, but check out the blog post for that. But yeah, get over to Interoptic, just as it sounds, as you know, interoptic.com/packet-pushers, and contact them directly to get a quote. And tune in to the weekly show that we had with an in-detailed discussion with Interoptic CEO Tim Dixon. We had a quite an interesting chat. He was very open and very frank about the whole thing, said where it was good and where their weaknesses were, so you should know exactly what you're buying. And I was quite impressed by the whole thing in the end.
All right, yeah, we'll have those links in the show notes, and head on over and take a listen to the podcast. And thanks, Interoptic, for being a sponsor. Okay, back to the news. Some good news for Nokia. Light Reading reports that Nokia's Nuage Networks unit has won a major deal with a Chinese insurance company. The company is going to deploy Nuage's virtualized service platform at 2 data centers.
Nuage Networks, of course, is one of the more unique SDN products because it's one SDN product for everything. Whether you run it in the WAN, whether you run it in the data center, it's all the same product. So it's one platform for all parts. And I wonder, from reading between the lines here, this is what I'm actually seeing, is it's sort of like a combination of a unified solution. You know, we've seen Nuage Networks has the virtual switching as well as the hardware, but it's also able to use the configuration engine to configure WAN appliances as well. And I can't get but read between the lines and think that that was a key part of what was going on here. Now, Nuage Networks has been part of Nokia, hence why it's the headline from Light Reading was Nokia lands non-telco SDN deal, because Nokia really has... I thought that was a little cheeky, but...
It was a little cheeky, yeah.
Yeah, a little. There's a certain amount of accuracy to that, and it's right. But I think the key here is that Nuage still remains the only SDN vendor. I mean, if you look at Cisco, for example, they have ACI for the data center, they have SD Access for the campus, they have a couple of SD-WAN solutions, they have about a half a dozen of them, they have a couple of other for the data center, and they're all different, and they're all supposedly unique, and, you know, for every customer, there's a different solution, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Juniper and Nokia both have just one. It's all Contrail for Juniper, Nuage Networks. There are some limitations inherent in that, but at the end of the day, one size fits all. And it actually does seem to be working for some customers. And so, yeah, good news for Nuage and Nokia.
Right. It's also a little bit of a victory for Nokia in that they scored this win sort of in Huawei's own backyard, which must feel nice after Huawei rolled into Europe and started kicking butt.
Yeah, I imagine so. And probably it's going to be linked to the fact that Nokia has a pretty substantial switching portfolio as well. So don't forget that they have an enterprise switching business unit. It doesn't mention it in this particular press release, but I do wonder if it's not related to that. This must be a customer maybe buying Nokia switches from the Avaya portfolio, I think.
Could be. Yeah, it didn't say in any of the information I read.
No, well, the press release came from the Nuage business unit, so perhaps that's why.
That could be.
Yeah. Welcome to big company politics. Yeah.
All right, some more business news. Extreme Networks, we've been following the various acquisitions that they've been undergoing. They've announced that they are going to buy the data center assets of Brocade Communications outright rather than wait for Broadcom's $5.5 billion acquisition of Brocade to close and then pick up the assets after Broadcom has to divest them. This deal should close in early November. In the meantime, the Broadcom acquisition of Brocade is still limping along. They've extended the acquisition deadline, but it looks like it's finally going to go through. But Brocade and Extreme reached a side deal, essentially saying, you know what, let's just do this data center asset deal. $55 million, let's wrap it up.
I think they had to, really, at this point. Who would go and buy switches from Brocade?
It must have been crushing Brocade to have all of this uncertainty. It's been like a year. That just can't be good.
No, and you do have to wonder what's going to happen at this point, because if Broadcom doesn't pick up the Fibre Channel soon, there's not going to be much business left, I don't think. So I think it's going to be an interesting sort of a thing. I suspect that Brocade was really struggling to sell any switches and bring on board new customers, because customers would be saying, well, you're either going to die or we're going to go to extreme. We need to have some certainty, so we'll just put everything on hold. And sure, you know, everybody who's got Brocade, you know, all maintenance contracts are still being honored and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, new business is where the heart is where the secret is. And I think in the end, Brocade said, look, we just have to get rid of this asset so that customers can move one way or the other. You know, just became to the point. And I know Broadcom, and we've talked that a few times, is that they have struggled to get the business unit sold. They're stuck with antitrust concerns in a couple of countries. I still think Cisco's putting sticks in the wheels here, you know, and others, because, you know, Broadcom might be getting just a little bit too much power across the silicon production facility.
Well, yeah, and we did report on how there's some restrictions on how Broadcom has to essentially build out its facilities for doing fiber channel so that it doesn't interfere with Cisco's own business. We can throw a link into the story about that. But yeah, that's part of the regulatory hurdles that Broadcom's been having to jump to make this deal go through.
Yeah, so I think there's some interesting stuff here. I suspect, you know, we're never going to know, I don't think. It's just never going to be clear. It seems unlikely that anybody's going to dive in here and find out the details. But just something just doesn't feel right. You know, why is Broadcom taking so long to get these things? It doesn't seem to me like it's a whole big deal. Why would foreign exchange boards care? But hey, what do I know?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's some secret fiber channel advocacy group somewhere making noise.
Yeah.
All right, our last story for the day, our surfing dog story. This is about Mattel, that's a toy maker. They have shut down plans for a smart monitor that was designed to interact with infants and young children. Essentially, it's a baby monitor, has a wireless camera, and it could also do things like adjust the lighting in the child's room or play soothing music if they hear the baby rustling around. And then it had an Alexa-like capability that it can engage in voice interactions with young children, so play games with them, sing songs, teach ABCs. And then a couple of people from Congress wrote to Mattel and said, hey, what are you guys doing about privacy and data protection? And suddenly Mattel's like, wait, okay, shut it down. Sorry.
You can't help but wonder what they're thinking. Did they really just so focused on getting this, they get so excited about this product and getting it out the door that they forgot to think, like, would people get upset about this product? And, you know, what's the brand damage? Just people don't want robots in the baby's room.
Well, not yet. I mean, they seem very comfortable with things like Alexa in the house, which is essentially doing the same thing. But yes, having it in your child's room takes it up a notch.
Yeah, there's a big difference between a 25-year-old liberal arts graduate who writes articles about tech for these mainstream sites who, you know, they put breathless prose about how fantastic the latest thing is, to very different for responsible parents who've got children that they have, you know, legal responsibility as guardians for. They do not want, you know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and if you've spat out a little crotch goblin that you actually care for and love and you hope to grow up into a little responsible adult, you actually, you know, this sort of stuff actually is matters. So I think there's a massive gap between sort of grown-up behavior that this represents and the sort of stuff we see in the press about, yeah, everybody should have an Echo in the bedroom with a camera. Like last, you know,
yeah,
like,
we did cover that. Yeah.
No. So you do wonder if, you know, these people just thought if we produced it, they'll come. Oh.
And considering just 2 years ago, 2015, Mattel took a lot of heat, the same company, because they put out a Barbie doll that was wirelessly connected and would record conversations that your child had with the doll. Took a lot of heat for exactly the same reason, right?
And they didn't secure the conversation.
And then they're like, let's get the babies. Give us the babies.
Oh, well, we're going for the wrong market. We'll go down for an even, yeah. Let's go for a softer target.
That's right. All right.
Another one where the CEO is missing in action, I would think. And all of a sudden, when Congress writes to the CEO, he goes, what? What are we doing?
Apparently, it was a brand new CTO who stepped in and was like, wait, what? Okay, no, shut this down. Yeah. Stop it.
Yeah. Oh, is that shortly after the previous one retired?
I don't know. Yeah.
He might have retired the day before and the new CTO shut it down. That was his job.
Could be. All right. On that note, this brings us to the end of our show. Greg, if people want to reach you on social, how can they do so?
You can find me on Twitter as at Ethereum Mind. You can also email me. If you've got something you'd like us to cover on the network break, email me or Drew. I'm greg.farrow@packetpushers.net. Love to see your links and your input. And any feedback, positive or negative, I prefer positive to negative, but I'll take out whatever I can get.
Yeah, you can also send us an email if you want to get on our Slack channel. We have a public Slack channel for Packet Pushers folks who are interested in chatting with us and chatting with other people in the industry, your peers. So send us an email. We can hook you up on that as well. I am Drew Condrimari. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. I blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsors, Nokia, Deepfield, and Interoptic. And thank you, of course, for joining us for Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook. Leave a recommendation on iTunes, because that really helps. Or share it with your friends. We've also launched a membership program. You get the Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation newsletters for free when you sign up to be a member. And we're also starting to add members-only articles and other little goodies. You can sign up at packetpushers.net/members. Thanks for listening.